Join me this morning in Genesis chapter 1. Going all the way back to the beginning, to the first chapter. In fact, I want us to read together the first five verses of the first book of the Bible. So this is Genesis 1, and in verse 1, where the text says, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was formless and void, and darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of the Lord was moving over the surface of the waters. Then God said, 'Let there be light.' And there was light. God saw that the light was good. God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. There was evening, and there was morning one day." And from there, the story continues. I'm going to go out on a limb here and guess that that is not the first time you have seen that passage in the Bible. In fact, not the first time that you have heard this story. This story offered to explain the beginning. Where did everything come from? The Bible answers that question right up front. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. In fact, I think that is probably the very first Bible story I ever learned. How about you? Certainly it's among the very first. In fact, maybe saying that calls to mind a Bible class bulletin board that looked something like that. Does that look familiar to some of you? With the pictures and the days that reinforce what was created on each of the days. Some of you saying, that was not in my Bible class growing up. I know, I grew up with the flannel graph too, so maybe it looked like that, right? Does that bring up any memories of learning the story as a child? In fact, I wondered as I went through this if in your brains some of you are now thinking a song, right? The song rehearsing the days of creation. Now I've ruined you all day. It's just going to be playing over and over again in your mind. It's what I grew up believing. That accounts for the world and everything we see in it. Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, I need to tell you a couple of things about this story that I suspect all of us are very familiar with. Probably most all of us have believed it our entire lives. But I need to tell you something about the story. Number one, just because that's true, we've been taught it, we believed it our whole lives, doesn't mean that it is the truth. Do you follow me on that? The second thing I want to tell you about that is there is in our culture a number of people, I think a growing number of people, who do not believe that this story is true. They would look back at Genesis 1 and they would contend that what we have in the opening of the Bible is an ancient creation myth that, frankly, in an enlightened culture like ours, anyone who would believe that that's how it happened would have to be a little bit uneducated and backward. And so let me tell you what that means for me and you. It means, brothers and sisters, number one, that we need to continue thinking about the story. It's not just something relegated to a children's Bible class. And number two, we need to be sure that believing the story is reasonable. And what I mean by that is that there's actually evidence to support the story that is told in Genesis. And I would contend that we should only believe it if it can be demonstrated to be true. And listen, I'm not afraid to say that. I think if you look at the evidence, it overwhelmingly confirms that the Bible explanation of the beginning is true and reasonable. But in a culture like ours, it's all the more important for us to know the reasons why, to know the evidence. But there's something else that I think we need to do. I also think it's important, brothers and sisters, for us to know the other story. Because if it is true, as unbelievers claim, that Genesis is a myth, that that's not how it happened, well, then what is the alternative? After all, we do live in a world of amazing living things, all kinds of amazing, complicated systems. That is reality. In fact, the deeper you get into science, the more amazing our world becomes. And as we look at all of that, it does press the question, how did it all come to exist? How did we come to be here in this place with all these living things and all these amazing systems at work? It seems to me sometimes that this conversation about origins, when we're talking to our friends about the beginning, winds up being one-sided. And that is, we just kind of pitch what we believe about that. We pitch Genesis out there, and the critics get to take shots at us, and that's the end of it. But should they not also have to account for this? What's their story? And they do have one. And oddly enough, in a church building on Sunday morning, I want to talk to you about the unbeliever's story, the story they tell about the beginning. I want to do that for two reasons. Number one, I think if we ponder more their story, it will help us to have meaningful conversations with people who are caught up in the growing unbelief in our world. I think we know a little bit, we need to know a little bit about what it is that they're thinking about the beginning. Maybe we can identify a few talking points for those conversations with them this morning. And then secondly, I want you to know the other story, brothers and sisters, because I think when you take what the Bible teaches and you lay it upside the other story, it helps you believe the Bible. Because one is clearly a more reasonable story than the other. I don't think that's what we hear in our culture. I would like you to see that with me this morning. So what I have selected are three chapters from the unbeliever's story that I'd like for you to ponder with me a little while this morning. And so imagine you are talking to somebody who does not believe in God, believes Genesis is a myth, and you ask, okay, where did all of this come from? How do you account for the world that we live in? I think the very first chapter in their story that they would go to is a chapter that we'll entitle evolution. Do you buy that? You see that? If you talk to people in the world about how everything came to exist and they reject the idea of God, I think what you will hear them default to most of the time is a theory of evolution. Now, you notice I've qualified that. I've listed that as macroevolution on the slide. And I think that's a really important clarification. And I'll tell you, it's for this reason. Everybody believes in evolution, including me and you, right? Everybody does. Everyone believes that living things adapt and change over time. Everyone believes that living things evolve. Dog breeders have been demonstrating that for a long time, right? They'll take one kind of dog and they'll breed it with another kind of dog and they'll come up with another ugly version of a dog, right? I know your dog lovers are in the crowd. I'm just not with you, so I'm going to use it to take a shot. What I need you to understand this morning is that the claims of this other story are far bigger than just living things change over time. What they've suggested is that one kind of animal can actually evolve into another whole kind of animal. And that is a different thing. And so the evolution story is that over billions of years, life begins first as very simple one-celled creatures in some kind of puddle way back when. But if you just give that enough time and chance, the little creatures will evolve into big creatures and then to fish and then to fish into reptiles and the reptiles into birds and on and on and on until you get to man, who at least currently is at the top of the evolutionary food chain. Maybe you've seen it illustrated this way with the tree of life, right? Have you seen this picture in some different form before with the littlest creatures down there at the bottom of the trunk, and then on and on up you go until we get the bizarre diversity of life that we see in our world today? That's a chapter from the other story. Do you see how different that is from Genesis? Genesis teaches that essentially all living things were made at the same time. And if we read on through the story, we would find that Genesis affirms that all animals reproduce after their kind. Now, the evolutionists will say, now, that story needs to be believed because their story should be believed because there is a mountain of evidence to support it, like what you'll find in this high school biology textbook. And so if you read the textbook, there's a lot of talk in there about bird beaks and fruit flies and peppered moths and things like that. Evidence that is presented to us as proof for that tree you saw just, well, the tree is still up there. Here's the thing you need to understand, folks. If you will pay careful attention, that evidence is not proving what they claim it proves. It's proving what we said at the beginning. Animals can change. It does not prove that they can change into other kinds of animals, which is key to the whole thing. They've done all kinds of experiments on fruit flies. That's why I've mentioned that to you. Fruit flies evidently have a short reproductive cycle. So you can, in a short bit of time, get many, many, many generations. And they've done a lot of things to fruit flies. And they have created through that process some goofy looking fruit flies. That when you're done, we're still fruit flies. You see it? And think about that. You have the smartest minds in the world in the most advanced laboratories working on something that they said nature did all by itself. And they can't do it. Why is that? Because there is no evidence that even if you give it a billion years, one kind of animal can become a different kind of animal. We know the dog thing works. We've seen that. Fish becoming reptiles. Not only has that not been replicated, but folks, there's no evidence of it. And there should be. Even if you can't reproduce it in a laboratory, if every living thing has evolved through this long process of gradual change from one kind of living thing to another, when we dig down into dirt and we find fossils, there ought to be millions of these transitional forms, these in-between creatures, some kind of creature that was sort of a fish and sort of a reptile, showing how the two are linked together. So how many examples of that does science have today? All the digging that's been done in the dirt hunting for them, how many of these in-between critters do we have? Well, it kind of depends on who you ask, because to be honest with you folks, I'm not sure you can identify even one example that is undisputed, not even one, in this textbook that you see in front of you, in front of me there. They show this guy. You know, y'all ever seen this before? Y'all know who that is? It's Archaeopteryx. And Archaeopteryx is supposed to be this critter from in between reptiles and birds. It's sort of part reptile, part bird. He kind of has some weird wings and some claws. And so some have said, there's an example. There's something that goes in between reptiles and birds. The only problem is, there are other evolutionists who have come along and said, no. That's not an in-between. That's just a weird bird. Because there are some of those out there, right? I don't know that there's consensus on even one example. And listen, the bizarre thing about that, folks, is that if it is true that every living thing has evolved this way, it's not about finding a couple or two dozen. There ought to be millions and millions of these. And we don't even have one that evolutionary scientists can agree on. So, I want you to think about what we have. In the Genesis story, all living things were created at the same time. That actually works with what scientists have found in the fossil record, and reproduce after their kind, which is scientifically what we observe today. The other story is that all life gradually evolved from one kind into another, a theory for which we have no evidence and which really has problems in the fossil record. Which story is easier to believe? I think that's worth thinking about and exploring. But actually, if I could digress for just a minute before moving on, I think we give away too much when we are even willing to talk about fossils and fruit flies. Because I think we've gone too far in this other story. We need to back up a little bit. And before that, ask a more fundamental question. How did we come to have living things at all? If there is no creator who in the beginning made all the living creatures, how did we come to have any living creatures at all? Why isn't Earth just like the moon, a big dead rock? Where'd the living stuff come from? And so we need to back up in the other story, and we need to talk about an earlier chapter. We'll call this chapter Spontaneous Generation because that's the language that describes getting life from non-life. And so now we're back to the puddle. Billions of years ago on the earth, where unbelievers say that life began. Now, we got to do something before we talk about the puddle. Because if you had a puddle on the moon today and put some chemicals in it, they wouldn't survive, right? Because the moon's conditions are not good for life. And so we need to talk, first of all, about how Earth came to be a place where living things could even exist in the first place. I am not a scientist. I am a preacher. But if you talk to people who know the science, what they tell us is the more they learn about the earth, the more amazing it is that life can exist here. I mean, there are just these very, very narrow conditions that have to be exactly right, or Earth would be lifeless. Let me offer you this explanation of that. Think about the astronauts that we launch out into space, right? We send the guys off into space. We put them inside a capsule that really brilliant people spent decades figuring out how to execute, because inside that capsule are the things you need for people to be alive out in space, right? And if that doesn't work, life wouldn't exist. And so we create this little capsule when we want to send men to the moon or up into space where they can exist, where they have the stuff they need for life to exist. Just think of that. Think of the earth rather as that on a much larger scale. This huge ball out in space where everything is done exactly right. The atmosphere is set just right. The conditions on the inside, the oxygen level, for example, set just right. There's a scientific term for this. It's called anthropic constants. It's the things that have to exist so life can exist on Earth. And it's just a very, very narrow window that allows that to be so. In fact, it's a little hard to believe that some rock out in space could come to be set just right for life to exist. In fact, even the atheists struggle with that. I was impressed with a comment made by the astronomer Sir Francis Hoyle, who is an atheist, who said, "It sure seems like some super intellect has monkeyed with physics, chemistry, and biology to get this just right. I think he needs to run with that idea." See, we're not even talking about getting life yet, folks. We're just talking about a place where life can exist. And even an unbeliever says, it's hard to imagine how that ever could have happened without a super intellect. So with that behind us, let's talk about the puddle. Because that's the story. That life began in this puddle on Earth billions of years ago. A chance would have it, in the puddle there would be all the things you need, all the chemicals to form the first very basic life form, and they would all be there in the right proportions, and they would be all put together in just the right way to form the first living cell. Now, Charles Darwin, who popularized this other story, Darwin thought that was no big deal. Darwin thought that was no big deal because Darwin knew nothing about DNA. As far as he could see, a cell was a relatively uncomplicated thing. But oh, folks, we've learned some things since Darwin talked about all this 200 years ago. The discovery of DNA, folks, has changed the conversation about origins. It's changed it dramatically because what they have discovered is that even within the simplest life form, there is DNA there coded to make cells do what they do and to make us who they are, coded with millions and millions and bits of data in the simplest life form. Someone says an amoeba has as much data in it as 10 sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Will you think about that? Millions of pieces of data that have to be perfectly put together for life to exist. Kind of hard to believe that nature coded all of that in that primordial puddle all by itself all those years ago. That seems a little hard to believe. Can I suggest to you that there are evolutionists who agree with you about that? It's a little hard to believe. I love the story of Dr. Dean Kenyon. Dr. Dean Kenyon was a biology professor at San Francisco State University and a committed evolutionist. So much so, Dr. Kenyon wrote a workbook, a college textbook, on this particular part of evolutionary theory. It was called biochemical predestination. And what he was trying to address is getting all the chemicals right in first life. How does nature do that on his own? He wrote a whole textbook about it that he made his class study, right? And so as he's presenting this to his class one semester, he said, one of my students started pushing back against me. He said, in fact, the student brought me a book that presented an argument against what I was saying. And he gave me all this extra data. So he said, I went home that summer and I started looking at this stuff. And he said, after spending months going over this, he said, I reached an unavoidable conclusion. There was just no way that my theory could be true. Can I be simple about that? There was no way nature could do DNA, folks. Kenyon eventually rejected the theory of evolution and has now embraced the other story, the Genesis story, which, as you can imagine, wreaked havoc on the campus of San Francisco State University. In fact, I'll tell you what they did, folks. They just took him out of the classroom. He was tenured. They couldn't fire him, but they wouldn't let him teach. So much for an honest examination of all the alternatives. Let me tell you how tremendous DNA, tremendous a problem that DNA is presenting from evolutionary theory. Scientists are scrambling to explain this and coming up with some rather odd explanations. In fact, perhaps the most well-known atheist in the world, Dr. Richard Dawkins, in an interview with Ben Stein, posited this theory. He said, perhaps we explained the very first life by saying that billions of years ago, aliens visited the planet and seeded the earth with these simple life forms that began the evolutionary process. He's not alone in that. Francis Crick, who helped discover DNA, has also offered this as a possible explanation. Really? Aliens is the answer? I'm not sure aliens fixes the problem. It just moves the problem to a galaxy far, far away. And secondly, folks, there's no evidence of aliens. Don't talk to me about Roswell. We're not going there. We make alien movies and we put them under a category. What is the category for alien movies? We call that science fiction. There's no evidence of that, folks. It has just been pulled out of thin air. And finally, if you're just gonna make up a beginner, why aliens and not God? There's a reason for that. Unless the aliens show up and put a phaser to my head, I don't have to do what they say. But if God exists, if I have a creator who made me, it changes everything. And so those who don't want to do what he said opt for aliens over God, but not because of the evidence. So what do we have? Genesis teaches that all living things are the work of an intelligent, powerful creator. I think that accounts for DNA. I think God can do DNA, don't you? We're going to start reading Romans this week. And in Romans 1, you're going to hit this early in your reading. This is Romans 1 and verse 20. Paul writes, "For since the creation of the world, His, God's, invisible attributes, His eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so they are without excuse." I love the play on words there. He talks about invisible things. Did you see that? That can be clearly seen. What is he arguing? He's arguing, brothers and sisters, that you can see God. You can see God through His work. You look at DNA, that amazing coding in our cells that makes us who we are, makes cells do what they do. When the millions of bits of information have been precisely put in place, so that cell will do what it's supposed to do. Boy, doesn't that look like God's signature is all over that? And candidly, folks, that's a lot easier for me to believe than the other story, that mindless forces of nature working without thought or purpose put together all the conditions necessary for life to exist on earth and then put all the chemicals in the puddle perfectly organized and coded so that something could be alive, or if you don't like that one, the aliens do it. Take your pick. I just don't have enough faith to believe that story. It sounds like a fairy tale. Can I digress one more time, though? I think we give too much ground when we talk to unbelievers and we're willing to grant the puddle. I think before we talk about the puddle, we need to talk about how it got there. And who made the chemicals to go in it? In fact, back up a little further. Who made the earth where the puddle sits and the chemicals are? In fact, who made the universe in which the earth sits? Where did it all come from? You see, we're talking about the beginning, but up to this point, we haven't really talked about the very beginning, where all this stuff comes from. And listen, you don't get to start with Big Bang either, right? Because if you're gonna have a Big Bang, you gotta have some stuff. You gotta have something to blow up matter, and you gotta have energy for that explosion. And something has to set it off. It has to trigger it. When we talk about the beginning, let's go all the way back to the very beginning. So, if Genesis isn't true, in the beginning, God, what's the alternative? I'm going to do something a little different this morning. I'm going to play a little montage of video clips from you. You guys will recognize this because I've probably showed this to y'all too many times. I show it to the young people over and over again. But I want to show you the video because I want you to hear the answer from the most famous atheist in the world. In fact, a couple of them. I want you to hear their explanation for where everything came from. I'm going to play this. You listen, see if you can identify how they explain the very beginning.
Of course it's counterintuitive that you can get something from nothing. Of course common sense doesn't allow you to get something from nothing. That's why it's interesting. It's got to be interesting in order to give rise to the universe at all. Something pretty mysterious had to give rise to the origin of the universe. You can dispute exactly what's meant by nothing, but whatever it is, it's very, very simple. And you... Why is that funny?
Well, I think it's a bit funny to be trying to define nothing.
Literally nothing. If you press Professor Krauss, he admits that he's not really talking about nothing. He himself says, and I quote, "By nothing, I don't mean nothing."
Nothing isn't nothing anymore in physics.
Nothing isn't nothing anymore in physics.
There could be literally nothing from which something suddenly springs. And I mean, it is very hard to grasp it, and I certainly can't grasp it.
Did you hear the answer? If you press unbelievers back far enough and ask the greatest minds among them, at least the most popular minds among them, this is the answer they give. What happened at the very beginning? First, there was nothing. And out of that came something. You may have noticed that at one point in the video, the audience laughs. Did you hear that? And I don't call your attention to that to mock Dr. Dawkins. I think it's important. The audience laughs because what he is proposing isn't just something they disagree with. The audience laugh because what he is proposing to them is so far beyond belief, they recognize it as silly, and they laugh at him repeatedly. Understand, folks, that is not scientific. Do you see that? You can't go into a laboratory and demonstrate how something can come out of nothing. In fact, it's counterintuitive to everything that we know about science. It is so obviously unreasonable that it struck the audience and all of you as well as being completely absurd. So why would they say something like this? These are certainly intelligent, educated people. Why would they make this argument? This is critical. I want you to hear me on this. It's all they've got. If you keep pushing this question, brothers and sisters, back far enough, at the end of the day, if you eliminate God, it's the only argument left. They can't even use the default of, well, we just haven't figured it out yet. We need to do some more scientific work. Do all the study you want. The universe had to have a beginning. And if it's not God, it's going to be something from nothing. So in the end, there is Genesis. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the alternative to that is, in the beginning, there was nothing. And out of it came something. You see, brothers and sisters, there really is a creation myth. A story about the beginning that is not supported in the science, and at times borders on such absurdity that it sounds like the stuff of fairy tales, believed by people who just want it to be true. But it is not the story found in Genesis. It's the evolution story that many have chosen to blindly embrace. I have been asked before, when I've talked to folks about this, I don't understand, David, if it is so crystal clear as you are suggesting, then why doesn't everybody believe this? In fact, we're talking about some of the great scientific minds of our age. Why doesn't the scientific community, why don't the brilliant people embrace it if it is so clear? And so, in answering that question, I would invite you back to the aliens. There's no evidence for aliens. Why do we have brilliant minds out there advocating that the explanation of life is that aliens visited the planet billions of years ago and seeded it here? Why do they believe the aliens? I will tell you, brothers and sisters, men choose aliens over God because they don't want anyone telling them what to do. And until the aliens show up, I could do exactly what I want to do. But if there is a God, it changes everything. My Creator, who brought me into existence, to whom I now am obligated. He has authority. As Jeff would say, he has a right to mess with my life, and one day he's going to come back and hold me accountable to his standard. Men choose aliens over God not because the evidence leads them that way. It's because they don't want to do what he said. But that's not the story we believe, is it? We believe in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Let me warn you, brothers and sisters, sometimes disciples wound up acting like practical atheists. And we need to be guarded about that. That we don't say we believe in the great creator and to go out and behave like nobody's telling me how to live my life. God exists. And you and I have to live like he exists. What does that mean? Bowing the knee every day to his will. Brings us to this invitation part of our service. It's possible that there's a believer in the crowd that has not been bowing the knee. Maybe you've been doing your own thing. If you had to admit it, life has practically been the life of an atheist. And it's time for you to rededicate yourself to being his child, taking his cue, following his lead. Or maybe you've never made that choice. Maybe you would be among those who believe there is a God, but you've never submitted yourself to him, pleaded with him to cleanse you of your sins, chosen to be his child, his follower. We have everything that you need to obey him today, if that's the choice that you need to make. But we need you to respond. This bench is reserved so that you can come take a seat down here and we can help you figure out your next step. So if that's you, during this song, make your way down to the front. While we stand, while we sing.